The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 120.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. I absolutely love talking to her and getting her incredible insight. She really needs no introduction. Her name is Lynette Zhang. Lynette, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Wow, George, what an introduction. I'm really honored. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, now I want to personally thank you because we had a conversation maybe a couple weeks ago, and you brought something to my attention I really hadn't researched very much. And this was this great reset that the, IMF. Yeah, the IMF and the World Economic Forum, this guy Klaus that runs the World Economic Forum, he's been talking about this with all his cronies. I dove into it after we discussed it, and I actually did a whiteboard video. It just completely blew my mind. But what's really amazing is how forthright, I mean, they're just laying it out saying, we want to change the entire society. We want a global reset and never go back to the way things were. I mean, it's very creepy if you listen to what they say. Their videos are just on YouTube. So can you, and you were the one that brought this to my attention. Mm-hmm. So can you walk us through, maybe the listeners or viewers that didn't see my whiteboard video or don't know what I'm talking about, can you get them up to speed on this great reset and then what you think their objectives are and then what the end game might be?
Well, I'll do my best, but getting them up to speed, I mean, basically, central banks have no tools left because their biggest tool is interest rate, and you basically have the world anchored at zero. And there's only so much debt, whether you're a government, a corporation, or an individual. At some point, you have to do something with that debt, whether it's, you know, service it, pay it, or default on it. So when you're in this kind of circumstance, the current system does not work. They need to put in a brand new system, and that's the reset. Now, where we are in it is there is currently a bill going through both, this is really interesting, George, Congress and the Senate simultaneously, which is not something that I think happens very often. So right. It's fast-tracked, and it's called Banking for All, where the Federal Reserve will actually create a digital money. And it's called, surprisingly enough, because they got to keep things as close to the same as possible, but this is the new money, the digital dollar. Right. They did the same thing back in 1913 when you had the gold certificates. It was a dollar. And after they installed the Federal Reserve, it was still a dollar. They did the same thing in 71. It was a dollar before they took gold out of the equation, and it was a dollar afterwards. So they know they have to keep everything the same. Now, in that one paper, which is really one of my favorites, or I don't know that it's my favorite, but they gave you such a beautiful 18-step outline of how they could transition us from a paper dollar system to a digital dollar system, excuse me, and this bill is number 8 on that list.
Wow. Who put out this list, Lynette?
The IMF in Breaking Below the Lower Zero Bound.
Oh, right.
Right? Which is how you go below zero, and you can basically, you can attack principal, which is one of the big threats in a digital currency. So right now in a paper currency, there's only 2 digits past that you can go. So, you know, you have 100 pennies make a dollar. Well, once you go down to zero, you can't go any lower. Right. But in a digital system, that's infinitely divisible. Mm. And the other big piece that people don't realize is that it gives the central bank direct and immediate control and their vision to see if their policy choices are doing what they want. So for example, this recent stimulus check of the $1,200.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people saved that money and we saw the savings rate spike to 33%. When what the government wanted, what the central banks wanted, was for people to go out and spend that money and stimulate the economy.
Right.
Now, once it's a digital, it's in a digital wallet, but it's still a digital dollar, well, then they have the ability to go below zero. And after that one piece, they did another piece on how to take it deeply below zero using a 4% as an example. So you've got this bank account and you have $1,000 in it, let's just say, and yeah. You're not spending any money, but you're now going deeply negative and you're just watching your principal evaporate. Mm. What are you likely to do? Likely to go out and spend it on anything that you think can retain its value better than in the bank. Right. And that's hyperinflation. So, I mean, maybe they're doing it a little differently, but we are now about to execute that piece. And by the way, they actually put a deadline for this in the bill of January 1st, 2021.
Mm.
So we're what?
Yeah.
4.5 months away?
Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind is, number one, negative interest rates and forcing people to spend that money, or it really encouraged them to waste the money, I would argue, just to consume, not to really invest. But then also, if they're, I'm just trying to think through the mechanics, what would have to happen, in my opinion, is they'd have to have the individual consumers, the average Joe and Jane, would have to have a reserve account with the Fed, because the Fed technically—
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it just creates bank reserves. And I had this conversation with Ron Paul. So if they're just creating bank reserves, then we, the individuals, would have to have a reserve account with the Fed, just like the JP Morgans and the Goldman Sachs. Now, most people might not think that that's a big deal. But then what happens is the Fed, or the government, is able to monitor every single transaction, every single thing you do. So you go on to the internet and buy XYZ thing that you might not want to talk about. Well, the Fed's going to know that. The government is going to know that. I mean, just think through the consequences of how that slippery slope with Big Brother that we get into. But I take it to the next step. And if they print up the bank reserves to put it into the accounts for, let's call it UBI, or the digital dollar with stimulus checks. And then you have to download your app in order to spend the money. Then not only can they charge you an interest rate for holding the money, but couldn't they just have that money expire within a certain time frame to try to create the velocity? I mean, how would that work on top of the negative interest rates?
Exactly. And you probably went in. I mean, actually, when a currency is dying, that's a very typical thing. You could just look over at Zimbabwe and, you know, they did it three times and they actually print an expiration date on the cash. But, you know, to your point, too, in this bill, you know what these accounts are called? Fed accounts.
Right.
So you have the digital dollar in a digital wallet, and they don't print it. It is just a ledger entry.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Right.
And the Fed account is actually, it looks like, it smells like, and it tastes like a regular bank account, because they know they've got to keep things as close to what you're used to as possible. And then they entice you. So no fees. They pay you interest, initially anyway. They pay you interest. There's no minimum balance. There's no maximum balance. There's no, let's see, they kind of danced around the overdraft fees, so I'm not really sure about that. because they didn't really specify.
Right.
But, and they also are saying in here that they will reimburse the banks for all costs. So they can, the banks cannot cancel these accounts because of profitability. They're going to make sure, because it is direct. And for governments, I mean, why do governments care about that? Because for them, it's about taxation. And in all of my research, how many times I have read about lifetime taxation, and if they have access to everything in your account, if they want it, they just pull it out. And what are you going to do about it? Nothing.
Yeah. I don't know if they'd even need to do that. Not that I would put it past them, but I don't know that they'd even need to do that, because if we think about the economic equation, that M2 plus velocity equals nominal GDP. Right. I mean, if you just think about that, just I don't want to bore people with the esoteric lingo. But the bottom line is, just you look at how many currency units are in circulation, and however many times those currency units trade hands, that's going to equal your nominal GDP. Now, of course, we only care about real GDP, but that's going to be nominal GDP. And that's what they need to really go parabolic in order to pay off this 26 trillion plus in on-balance sheet debt, not talking about the off-balance sheet debt, but just on-balance sheet. And that's really, I think, one of their main objectives, is to just deleverage this debt through an inflationary spiral, call it. So if they can control the M2 money supply and velocity, they can control the entire equation. And then they can just turn the dial up and down on however much debt burden they want to reduce by paying it back with cheaper currency units.
Exactly.
So I don't think people really understand the power that it gives the government just by going from, I mean, I don't even like fiat currency, but at least it's a green piece of paper in my hand, Lynette.
Right.
this digital dollar.
It is a debt instrument that has a zero coupon. In other words, it doesn't charge you interest. It doesn't pay you interest. This is the problem for them going deeply below zero. They've got to get rid of it. But if they go in and they take it away from you, well, now you're hackled on. No, what are you taking away my dollar? They want you to volunteer it. And a lot of people have volunteered it during this corona pandemic.
Yeah, right. But I think people that would be have the opposite side of the argument would say, oh, Lynette, you're just worried, you're just fear mongering or whatever. We already have a digital dollar. So what's the big deal if the Fed has a digital dollar? You know, I don't use these green pieces of paper, these antiquated little coins or something. I just use my debit card. It's already digital. That's my point, and that they don't realize that no, there's a big difference between the quote unquote digital dollar we have today compared to what they're talking about in this bill. It's a night and day difference, really.
It's crazy, because right now the way the system is set up, they can make policy, and then the bank's job is to carry out that policy. But it takes 18 months to go through the system to see if they are getting the results that they want. This makes it instantaneous. So if you aren't spending fast enough, guess what happens to your principal balance? It evaporates that much faster to inspire you to volunteer. And frankly, this is really what makes physical gold and silver in your possession that much more critical. Because 100% of the time, you can convert it into whatever that current currency is, and therefore protect your purchasing power, which is what matters to people. What can I buy with these dollars, whether they're paper-based or digital-based or anything? What can I buy with them? Because that's what we really need. So, and I personally modified my strategy once I saw the digital dollar coming in, because I had originally, based on history, thought that once we made that full transition, that I would convert the lion's share of my gold holdings into the new currency when it was more stable, et cetera. But I have modified it, and I'm not going to. I will convert it as I need it so that I can protect my purchasing power.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really what it's all about. So I want to get into that more in just a moment. I'm looking at my notes. But one thing I really wanted to get your feedback on, it's something I've been thinking about a lot. And I know most people might not know this, or at least my viewers, but and maybe we can just go over that quickly. As far as your background in this business, you've been doing it a long time, and you were right there in 1987. We discussed that. You saw the stock market crash. You were a broker. You understand how the dynamics of buying and selling really work. So if you could just give us the quick 30-second Reader's Digest version of your background to set up and give some context. Then I want to ask you a question about passive investing and how it's restructured the stock market and some potential risks that are there that I don't think people are realizing.
Oh, absolutely. But George, frankly, I have been groomed for this moment in time. And while I was a stockbroker in 87, I really started in the tangible area when I was 10 years old, so 1964, because my uncle was a major antique dealer back east, and he was my favorite uncle. And there's something, so, and he was very high end. So I don't know why this would stick in a 10-year-old's head, but my parents and I were at his house, and he said to my parents, if anything should happen to me, Aunt Bertie, his wife, would be well taken care of for the rest of his life, her life, because of what's in these safes. And he had two tall floor safes. So I turned around to look, and what I saw was that they were packed with gold coins. You couldn't get one more gold coin in there. Now, this is significant because it was 1964. And it was illegal to hold more than 5 ounces of gold at that time, except for the way that he was holding them, because they were all pre-1933 gold coins.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because, and additionally, right around that same period of time, the government, though I didn't know this then, but the government legalized gold certificates once again, though you couldn't convert them into physical gold, but you could buy them at $35 an ounce. And I'm going to tell you right now, it always seems like nothing's happening. It's slow, slow, slow until it's fast. Yeah. And I know how many people knew about that in 1965 when they did it. Just the insiders, right? So then in 71, after that, it was then those were legalized. Well, they were legalized in 65. But then after, 86, you could come, or not 86, 76.
One,
you could, no, it was something. I'm getting really excited. Sorry. I'm very passionate about this because, you know, how many times can you be lied to when you don't know the truth? Right. And, you know, this really influenced me a tremendous amount. We know that once they decoupled gold from the currency, we know what happened to spot. So all those insiders that knew that this was going to happen, boy, they were set up quite beautifully at a fixed rate at $35 an ounce on those contracts. But my uncle was set up quite nicely permanently by those 1933 coins because you could actually use them in the normal public since they were actually legal to hold, which was a loophole they wrote in 1933. So what he taught me was how tangible asset the flow, right? From undervaluation to fair valuation to overvaluation to fair valuation to undervaluation.
Right.
Right? Same things happens with everything, real estate, anything that's tangible. And then because my father was a developer in a small town, he had, you know, he's kind of a bigger fish in a little pond. And so I got to start working in banking when I was 15. Studied business finance, stayed in banking until I had my children and got divorced, needed to make more money. became a stockbroker, right? I mean, life just kind of flows. You don't necessarily know. But there was this one little window where I happened to stumble across non-dollar denominated bonds. And that's all about currencies. And back in the day, non-dollar denominated bonds.
Right. Were they Carter bonds?
Pardon me?
Were they Carter bonds?
No. They were, I was particularly drawn to New Zealand bonds. They were corporate. I remember a five-year New Zealand dollar bond from McDonald's at a 12.5 coupon, a five-year bond. Wow. So it was a play on the currencies, but the actual point, it was one of the best deals I ever did, quite honestly. But one of the point of that was at that time I was with Shearson. And you could call the head of the trading desk and have direct conversation with them. Mm-hmm. So I spent about a year and a half every morning talking to the head of currency trading at Shearson. And it was, so I'd go home at night and I'd study. And then in the morning we would have that conversation. And honestly, it was only available for about a year and a half, because then after that, you couldn't do non-dollar denominated bonds. They put them in mutual funds. And now all of the income from it, we were getting about 25% between the coupon and then the exchange rate. Wow. So that was on a five-year AAA paper. That was pretty nice, you know. But when Wall Street saw that, they're like, oh, heck no, that's our money. And then the deal was not as sweet. Though still a lot higher than what you're getting, you know, right now. And these weren't junk bonds. I'm kind of digressing here for a second. But did you happen to see that Ball Corp, a junk rated corporation, issued 10-year paper at 2.9%, below 3%?
No, but I'm sure the Fed bought it. And there's a special purpose vehicle or whatever.
Exactly. So, you know, that's why I said I have been groomed for this moment in time, because if I hadn't done all of those pieces, I understand the language.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's my mission, is to translate that financial noise that they intentionally make so complex and so complicated that people go, oh, well, no, I don't understand that. So they must know what they're doing. Well, they do and they don't.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
And since you have so much experience on the retail side with the average investor, I mean, it goes right back to your point that you're saying. They're just like, I don't want to talk about it. I just want to focus on Sunday football, or, you know, my kid's soccer game or something like that. I just don't want to really think about it. Let me just put it into a 401k. Let me put it into an IRA. What percentage of just the average people that, you know, going back to your decades of doing this, do you think are just in a 401k? They just put it into an index fund and just try to go passive to lower the fees and just set it and forget it and just focus on their everyday lives. What percentage of the retail investor do you think have that mindset?
I think, God, that'd be a very high mindset. I would say probably at least 85 or 95%. I would say mostly. Although now you have this new breed of traders, the Robinhood traders.
The right. Davy Trader Global or whatever.
Right.
Let's take that stimulus check we'll buy Hertz. Let's take our stimulus checks. We'll buy Chesapeake. Right. But where I'm going with this is I just listened to a recent podcast with Bill Fleckenstein, Grant Williams, and Mike Green, who I'm super, super excited to have on my show here coming up soon. But he has done a really extensive deep dive into this passive investing and how it's become more and more popular and how it differs from active investing and some potential problems that may occur. Well, so this is what I really want to get your feedback on.
Like hurting, right? Passive investing, are you referring to part of it has got to be the hurting? Well, so the herd mentality?
Yeah, if we think about how a passive fund works, like an index fund, there's no discretion. They don't look at a multiple. All they do is when you give them $100, they have to buy with that $100. That's the only decision-making process they have. If they have $100 come in, they buy $100 of whatever the underlying asset is, the stock, let's say the S&P 500, the Dow. If they have $100 go out, then they have to sell that underlying assets, $100. That's it. Know active managers, they're not doing that. They have valuations. They're using other metrics to determine whether or not they buy or sell. So if we take this, if we know that more and more people and more of the assets are the investable assets are moving towards passive, mm-hmm. and if we try to figure that out, take it to its logical conclusion. Let's say we get to a point where 99% of the assets are in a passive fund or funds, plural. And let's say on net, of course, obviously, they're always having people who want to take out some money and people who want to take and put in money. But we have this baby boomer, a glut of the population retiring. So they're going to want to take out money. But only 1% of the assets are in the hands of the active managers, and they're not going to buy unless the price is right. So let's say that that underlying asset is a $100 stock, and you have 2% of the assets in the passive fund that wants to sell. But even if the active fund wanted to buy at a given price, they don't have the money. The money doesn't exist. So the bid goes from 100 basically down to zero. You have a zero bid. So you theoretically have this model where the stock market could go to zero. Because there's no bid. And it doesn't mean that the underlying assets don't have any value. It's just that there's absolutely no liquidity. And you're stuck there in this passive fund where you literally can't get your money back. And so people say, well, that's an extreme example, George. And it is true that. But the closer we get to that 99% mark or the 100% mark, the more volatility you're going to have when there's net sellers in the passive funds. So I know so many people right now that might not be interested in gold and silver and commodities and these hard assets that you and I are talking about because they'd much rather be in these financial instruments that have been created by this financial engineering. And they look at Warren Buffett and he says just go into passive and in an index fund and you'll be fine. And they see this as a quote unquote safe thing to do, but they don't understand the structure and how that's right. How the structure of the market with the buyers and the sellers has completely transitioned and been distorted over the past few decades. That's probably since you really got into the business. I would imagine that passive really became kind of in vogue back in the 1980s and 90s. So I really wanted to get your insight on that whole concept.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of opinions on this, actually. And the real passive investing, actually, even though it was there prior to, it exploded after 2008. That's okay. When the explosion and the big move to the passive happened. ETFs are really exchange-traded funds. That's kind of a new financial instrument. And the way that they're structured, they don't really have to hold any cash for those liquidations. So just to kind of add on to what you were talking about, if people go in to liquidate or sell the ETF, right? Well, then that flows through to their approved counterparty. So the bank, let's say, and then the bank is really the one that has to pay out the investors. But what does the bank get? They get the underlying stocks or whatever is invested in. And the range of that investment, typically when you look at the composition of an ETF, is really, really narrow. So where we're talking about, oh, let's say Apple stock. A lot of people own Apple stock, right? But if you pulled up all of these different ETFs, what you would find is that their holdings are primarily the same. And so that's what I was referring to before with the herding. So you see, you know, Apple going to $2 trillion in market cap, but that's on price earnings multiple expansion, not actual earnings.
And not
expansion.
Fundamentals, because there's no decision making on the fundamentals. It's only just we have more money, we buy. That's it.
Exactly. So the more money that goes in there, but then again, to your point, the more money that comes out, again, there's no decision making. Mm-hmm. So that's why the Fed had to go in and pump in all of this liquidity in the markets, because the system is falling apart. I mean, it is. It's falling apart. And definitely what's happening in the stock market does not reflect what's happening in the regular market, you know, in the normal economy at all. So for those people, and not only that, but it's this nominal confusion piece. When they created this fiat system, they absolutely knew that people do not understand inflation. And it's genius. I mean, it really is. So for example, just for people that aren't familiar with that, if you had a $20 bill 10 years ago and you have a $20 bill today, nominally, they're identical. They're both $20 bills. But what that $20 bill bought you 10 years ago or a year ago is vastly different than what that $20 bill buys you today. So by pushing the stock market up and inspiring people to stay in it and put more wealth in it. Well, what does that mean? Let's say it goes to 10 trillion. Well, 10 trillion times zero is still zero, because this entire time, the purchasing power value of those dollars is declining. And that's the only thing you can convert those things into, if you can actually convert, which is what my concern is. And with these ETFs and the passive investing, I mean, 100%. How many trading halts did we have in March?
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, because it was invisible to most, because they don't really, the system is made intentionally complex so that people just think they can't get it, but you can. And whether you're a passive manager or you have a passive index fund or even the professionally managed ones, what are they playing with? Other people's money. Sorry, but you know, when you look at what's happening to the pension plans right now, and the law was recently changed that allows them to go into private equity. And do we not remember all the unicorns that were, you know, coming to the market, and they had zero. I mean, seriously, no earnings. In fact, massive losses as far as the eye could see. But yet they had a $20 billion valuation, market valuation, because of the private investing. And then when they came to market, even Levi's that had some positive cash flow, right? And who doesn't know Levi's, right? But they came to market, they got bid up immediately after they came to market, but they have no earnings. They have losses. How does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's financial engineering.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's just forced upon the average individual since 1913 through inflation, because they have no way of getting ahead, Lynette, because their savings are decreasing in value. So the only way that they can increase their purchasing power and have some prayer of retirement is if they go further out the risk curve. And that's by going into financial assets like these 401ks, these passive funds that we're talking about, where people really don't understand the true underlying risk. I was doing some research this morning about wages, what would be equivalent to the minimum wage from 1752 to 1860. So almost 100-year span. And in 1752, it was about 33 cents per day. Okay. In 1860, right around a dollar. So nominal wages went up by almost 200%. But during that same time frame, we had the prices of goods and services go down by 34%. You know, 34%. So most people say, oh, well, okay, that's kind of a fun statistic. They don't really think it through. What that means in today's dollars, if you would have started with your expenses at $2,000 a month, let's say minimum wage, your income at $2,000 a month, so your net just wash, you don't have any disposable income. And or any savings, any investment. After this time frame, after these numbers, we run these things. At the end, you would be making $6,000 a month, and your expenses would be maybe $1,200 a month or $1,400 a month. You see, so your standard of living would increase substantially, I mean, dramatically. And the tweet that I put out was, the free market and capitalism did this. Hard money being backed by gold. This
exactly.
is what did this. Show me the government. Show me the central planner that eradicated this much poverty. It isn't out there, but it goes back to your point. And so many people don't realize this. They try to look at the symptoms and treat the symptoms. Well, they say, oh, there's so much wealth inequality. We've got to increase taxes, or we got to do this, or we got to do that. Mm-hmm. They look at a symptom, but the underlying cause is the Fed and inflation. And if we could somehow get rid of the central planner's ability to create more currency units, it solves everything. It solves everything.
Well, you know, up until actually 1927, up until 1927, all central banks had a lifespan typically between 15 and 20 years, because governments knew that they would end up destroying the value of the currency.
Right.
But so the Federal Reserve in 1927, and I don't think that that's a coincidence either, mind you, was the first time that any central bank had an unlimited charter. Unlimited. It's ridiculous. And further to your point, you know, when they set this whole system up, but let's go back to 1971. The average wage then was $9,500. And one wage earner, a family of four, could live on that. I'm not saying they were ultra wealthy, but they only needed one wage earner to do that. Mm-hmm. Today, I think the average wage is like $53,000. So most people will go, well, wow, I'd much rather have $53,000 than $9,500. Well, yeah, except you need two wage earners. You're still paycheck to paycheck. And look, anybody under $75,000 a year got that $1,200 stimulus check.
Yeah, right.
Right? You see the point?
And they're paying higher taxes because the tax brackets haven't gone up at the same rate as inflation.
Right. I mean, it's genius because the government and the central banks create this inflation and then they get to tax it.
Yeah, right.
And inflation is really an invisible tax on your wealth and your working. So, you know, when you talk about the income inequality, it was enabled because of that nominal confusion, right? Mm-hmm. No, 53,000. Wow, I'm doing pretty good. No, you're not. You're really not doing pretty good. But what is inflation based on? It's goods and services, right? So corporations make more money. They pay their employees, the average employee, less. That enables more for the top. And then the further financial engineering with the stocks and then the stock buybacks and the warrants, right? So part of the package, you got your salary, then you have all of these stock options,
right,
which enable you to buy stock at a certain price within a certain period of time, you know, and then, I mean, we see it all the time where a company will come out and talk up their stock and then the insiders, the high guys that have all those options, exercise those options and sell their stock. And they capture all that money and go out and buy hard assets.
Yeah,
about
it's cronyism. It's cronyism, and people, for whatever reason, consider that capitalism. But I like to rebrand capitalism as just free markets, the free market ability to make your own decisions and to hold your personal property. And I think if we were able to rebrand it, most people would go along with that because the average person on the street, I mean, they're not going to be against that. You say, hey, do you believe in free markets and the ability for you to own your own private property and make your own decisions? I think you get very few people that would disagree with that or take issue there.
Rise and fall on your own efforts.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
That's a big part of it.
Right, but it comes from the top down, too. You got to lead by example. And I always used to say that as an entrepreneur, but if we have the government that is propping up all of these zombie corporations going back to 2008, we're not leading by example. We don't have any creative destruction. Schumpeter, when he came up with that concept, it was absolutely brilliant. And it's so true that you have to let these big businesses go bust and have the people that were prudent, these young entrepreneurs, come over and take over the assets and structure it in a way that's going to be far better in the future. And it's going to be where our economy is built on a sustainable foundation. I find it ironic that everyone's talking about sustainability right now, but they're completely ignoring the fact that we're propping up these zombie corporations and we're not even thinking about profits as though right. That doesn't even matter for a business right now. One thing I wanted to get your opinion on before we go back to gold and silver, Lynette, is another thing I've been thinking about quite a bit, and that when we look at the Fed and just the narrative, whether it's in our space or even kind of the talking heads on CNBC, Bloomberg, it's always, I think, hyper-focused on the balance sheet. We're always talking about the Fed's balance sheet going from to 7 trillion from 4 trillion, or the Fed's balance sheet is expanding and it's infinitely expandable. But one thing I was thinking about the other day is their profit and loss. And if you make the assumption that the Fed is owned by private individuals and it's not owned by the government, that's a rabbit hole we don't want to go down. But if we just make that assumption for a moment, if I owned the Fed, if you and I owned it 50-50, I think we would be concerned maybe even more so on the P&L than the balance sheet. So when people say that, but all their profits go to the Treasury, no, they don't. If you actually look at it, they're very vague about certain accounts that they have where, yes, they pay a 6% dividend to the shareholders, you know, whoever these people are or entities are. But there's a gray area there, to say the least. Just assume for a moment they are concerned about the P&L. Then, I mean, if you're the Fed and you can print limitless bank reserves to buy financial assets, wouldn't you buy the financial assets of Apple, or going back to bonds, corporate bonds, like you were just talking about, wouldn't you buy the corporate bonds of Microsoft, of Apple, of all these companies that you know you're going to get paid? So whenever I see the Fed, you know, bailing out these companies that have $100 billion of cash on their balance sheet and everyone's scratching their head, I'm like, well, maybe that's a tell that they're more focused on the P&L than the balance sheet, because they're getting paid. What do you think about that?
It could be, but I'm going to throw a little something in there from their own. I can't tell you exactly where off the top of my head, but I think it was an IMF report, or it could have been a Fed report, where in reality, I don't know if they really even care about the P&L, because you know who's really responsible for their balance sheet? Taxpayers. You and me.
Yeah.
We're responsible for any losses of the Fed. Boy, if they were responsible, if they really were looking at their P&L, look at all the garbage and the legacy derivatives that they have taken off the bank's balance sheet just since 2008.
Yeah, but I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you hit the nail on the head where the losses are socialized. But if private individuals, again, let's just say you and I owned the Fed, and we had a societal put. I don't even know what to call it. But society is going to backstop our losses. But if we, whatever profits we make from buying Apple and Microsoft and all these things, or mortgage-backed securities, whatever, then you and I get to pocket that. And we have no expense to buy these things, because all we have to do is just type in a few more currency units in their reserve account, JP Morgan or whomever we're buying these assets from. I mean, I think if you look at it, and I know this is going way out of the box and putting my tinfoil hat on, but I think if you look at it through that lens, a lot of the decisions and the actions the Fed has taken over the past few weeks and the past few months since we've gone through this, all these crazy things with the virus, it kind of makes sense that, okay, if I was in a situation where all of my profits were privatized, I'm putting in my back pocket, but the taxpayer is taking my losses, and I get to print all this money to where I can buy all these assets. I mean,
why not?
I'd buy the best assets out there. I'd want to bail out, or quote unquote, bail out all these companies where I know all that profit's going right into my back pocket long term. I don't know. I just think there might be something there.
Well, I think there is actually quite a bit there. And I think that's by design, to be perfectly honest with you. So, you know, that's why for me personally, I do not want these guys to remain in power on the other side of this mess. And I don't think that going to the digital dollar is the end of this mess. I think it is ratcheting the mess that we're in up.
Yeah.
I mean, we have an awful lot more pain ahead of us. An awful lot more pain.
So let's go through how people can take more control over their own financial future by owning gold and silver. I think most of my viewers understand my position on gold. I think you got to own it. It's insurance in your portfolio. Whether the price is going up or down, it doesn't really matter. It's still serving its purpose, and that's maintaining your purchasing power over decades, over the long term. But before we started recording, you and I had a quick conversation about silver and maybe the value that you've been talking about in a lot of your videos, and I'm not to talk about the price. So can you go into that a little more in detail?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't have known any of this had I not done that, talk to that currency, the head of currency trading at Shearson, quite honestly, because that really set me on a path of studying currencies and looking at repeatable patterns. These are things that happen every single time. Obviously, gold has been money for 5,000-6,000 years because of its full utility, but silver as well. So, but it's for a different function. Mm-hmm. So I created, which is what we executed ITM. I created a strategy for myself before I even got there in 2002 based upon those repeatable patterns, because I don't know, history repeats itself.
Right.
And what I think everybody needs to do is have a plan where you're looking at what is it that you are trying to accomplish. For me personally, I'm almost 66 coming up, and I have children and I have grandchildren. So I want to make sure that I have income that I cannot outlive, right? Number one, right now, if everything is in the fiat markets, they're telling you, well, at 87, you're out of money based on, that's based on ideals, but you want income that you cannot outlive. And then because of where we are being led by the nose, it's so important for me personally to make sure that my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren retain choice and retain freedom. Mm-hmm. So leaving a legacy for me is very, very important. So I created the strategy based on those repeatable patterns, and you look at what you're trying to accomplish, and then you say, okay, so what functions do I need to perform? One of the things that we all need to do is sustain our current standard of living. And that means that when that money is disappearing from your account or the prices are going through the roof, either way, then you want to still be able to go out and buy that box of strawberries or put that tank of gas in your car. Mm-hmm. When the currency is no longer trusted. And that's really where silver comes in.
Right.
And pre-65 is 90% silver. So you've got dimes that are a tenth, roughly. They're not really, they're not quite 3/4 of an ounce because they're 90%. But okay, just to make it simple for people overall, you know, a dime is roughly a tenth of an ounce. A quarter is roughly a quarter of an ounce. A half dollar is roughly a half an ounce. And a silver dollar is roughly an ounce. So you have different sizes because during this period, change becomes irrelevant, right? What are they going to give you? Look at what happened when they closed the banks in Greece. And if you were lucky enough to have cash so you could buy something with that cash, they couldn't give you any change back. They gave you candy bars.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm dead serious. This is not a joke.
I didn't realize that.
They couldn't give you cash back. So, but if you have silver, I typically like the smaller denominations as an overall percentage, because it's easier to put two dimes together than to break a quarter in half. Mm. But I know a lot of people talk about the silver gold ratio and blah, blah, blah. You know, I did a study on what happens during hyperinflation to that ratio, and you got to have gold because gold is the primary currency metal and it's what they reset the currencies against. But right, so it typically, through those kinds of transitions, it does outperform in terms of purchasing power, mm-hmm, better than silver. Okay. However, you're not going to take a gold coin to the grocery store because you're not getting any change back. You are much better off taking a silver dime or even a silver bracelet, because gold and silver in any form are monetary at its base. And that's one reason why you see me wear jewelry. Yeah. Because if you don't think I would take off this ring and use that to barter my children's life or future, this is how a lot of people escaped in Europe during Nazi Germany's reign.
Oh, Asia, you look at history all over the world. It's how people have gotten out of tough situations.
Exactly. And honestly, this is absolutely no different. So I do think that silver is a critical part of your portfolio. And in the strategy that I developed, and I've got all the formulas in there, it's on a spreadsheet. So based upon your personal living standards and what you want to accomplish, like for me, I wanted to make sure that my children would have enough silver as well. So right, I took into account all of their debts, and you're big into real estate, right? Mm. Okay, well, globally on average, I'm going to gold here for a second, but globally on average, 25 ounces of gold or the equivalent would buy an entire city block, buildings and all during these kinds of transitions. So, you know, you need both. It's not one or the other. It's like, what am I trying to accomplish?
Right.
We talked about passive income. Well, you know, it would take this whole room of silver to buy that commercial building or that Senate house or that mandatory parking lot or something like that, that can generate income for you. Mm-hmm. And even mortgages, right? Let's make life easy for a second. And let's say that you had a mortgage balance of $100,000 and that you could buy an ounce of gold for $2,000, right? All right. So right now, if you had $100,000, you had a choice. You could either buy 50 ounces of gold or pay off your mortgage. Well, right now that you still have some purchasing power in that those dollars, because you could still buy that gold, right? So what would take 100? Well, maybe all you need is 5 ounces of gold when it goes to its fundamental value, or maybe even a quarter of an ounce, depending on how high that goes, to pay off that mortgage.
Right. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So you want to make sure, and even with your stock portfolios, let's say you are in a 401k or a 403b or something like that, that you can't or don't want to take out of the market. Well, a truly diversified portfolio is not fiat stocks, fiat bonds, fiat mutual funds, fiat ETFs. That's all one basket. That's all fiat. You need to have that commodity money over here, so that when right now this is where it is, overvaluation, undervaluation on the commodity money, that's going to shift. So to protect all of that principal and the purchasing power value of that current principal, you've got to have your gold to do that. So you absolutely need silver for a barterable position, but you also need the gold to protect your wealth and position you to take advantage and, frankly, execute exactly the same strategy that you pointed out the governments and central bankers are paying off these debts within this country, dollars that have no value.
Yeah, or less and less value. Yeah. What we need, Lynette, is you and I need to start a fund where we buy cash flowing real estate, but we have all our renters pay us in gold and silver coins and take out 30 year fixed rate debt to do it. So we're getting paid gold to short the dollar through a hard asset that's built with commodities. You can't get any better than that.
I would love that. I am always happy to get paid in gold and silver. Always.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lynette, for your time. I was so excited to talk to you because whenever we have the opportunity to do this, it's always just a tremendous conversation.
It is.
For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about your company, what you do, where can they go?
Well, I have there's a YouTube channel, ITM Trading. I'm the chief market analyst there since 2002. So they can Google my name, Lynette Zhang, and I'll probably come up. But I put material out constantly on that, just like you do on yours. And it is really about translating that. They can also go to itmtrading.com. That's our website. And we're all here to be of service. Everybody there, all of the consultants are trained in the strategy. That is really, that's what makes us different. Anybody can throw you into gold and silver, but is what you're doing going to support your goals? So they've all been trained in my strategy, which is what everybody there is executing, just kind of tweaked for their personal circumstance. And that's how they can find me. Or they can call at 888-696-4653.
All right, Lynette. Thank you very much for your time. Can't wait to do it again.
Absolutely, George. I always have such a good time with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.